You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Confessions of a Mob Chef by Gabriel Sherman, with photos by Gillian Laub. The new affiliation came with a requirement. Lombardozzi expected that members of his crew would find legitimate jobs to deflect law enforcement attention. Ruggiero had dim prospects. He was recently expelled from high school and had a criminal record. He did, though, have a secret passion, cooking. If he had to get a job, then he wanted to be a chef. Next photos, pressure cooker. Ruggiero in his teenage boxing days. In the kitchen at Maxim's, while hosting the meal of the century with chefs Gray Kunz, Michel Richard, and Jean-Louis Paladin with Jacques Pepin at the James Beard House, on a PBS cooking show set. Despite his heritage, Ruggiero had no desire to work in an Italian kitchen. Italian restaurants were junk in those days. They were red sauce places, you know, glorified pizzerias, he said. In the early 1980s, French cuisine dominated the New York dining scene, and that's the food Ruggiero aspired to cook. I went to the Kings Plaza Mall, where there was a B. Dalton bookstore, he recalled. I bought all the French cookbooks by Julia Child, Auguste Escoffier, and Jacques Pepin, he recalled. I started memorizing French terms. I consumed the New York Times food section and J. Jacobs restaurant reviews in back issues of Gourmet magazine. After all that reading, I knew what the top restaurants were. One of them was La Caravelle. The menu had barely changed since the restaurant opened in 1960. It featured classics such as canard de brochet, striped bass, Julienne, and oeuf à la neige. I walked in, and it was like something out of a movie, Ruggiero recalled. The kitchen was in the basement of the Shoreham Hotel. There were all these Frenchmen in pristine white toques and big hats running around. There was no English being spoken. After lunch service one day, Ruggiero approached the chef, Roger Fessiguet. Before I could get three words out, though, he goes, "No, I'm not hiring. Leave." Right then, I decided this is where I was going to work. In the spring of 1981, La Caravelle hired Ruggiero as an entremetier, a junior cook who mainly works with vegetables and soups. There was a mind-numbing amount of information to absorb at a breakneck pace in a language he barely understood. Chefs would yell out an order for consommé tosca and another for consommé verpré, and he'd have to immediately know the difference between one: chicken consommé, thickened with tapioca and garnished with julienne carrot and quenelle of chicken, truffles, and foie gras, and the other, chicken consommé garnished with finely cut vegetables and fresh sorrel. He kept the book, Le Repertoire de la Cuisine, at his station, and feverishly flipped through it when he got lost, which was often. Those first couple of services were pure hell, he recalled. They screamed at me all the time. But the more they screamed, the more I wanted it. I knew that if I stayed in the street, I was going to get killed or go to jail. Ruggiero quickly understood that a French kitchen was not dissimilar to La Cosa Nostra. Both were governed by rigid hierarchies and old-world codes. Transgressors were punished harshly. At La Caravelle, they would inspect your drawer twice a day, and if your knives weren't clean and sharp, they threw everything on the floor, Ruggiero said. He respected how the imperious owner, Robert Meissen, enforced the dining room's dress code like a hardened don. He once didn't let Jackie Kennedy in because she was wearing pants, Ruggiero recalled. Another time, Ralph Lauren showed up wearing one of those Western leather bolo ties. Meissen told him he had to wear a tie. Ralph said, "I am wearing one." Meissen pointed at it and said, "No, you tie horses up with that." He threw him out. Lauren did not respond to a request for comment. When Ruggiero wasn't in the kitchen, he was knocking heads in the street. I would often go with guys to small stock brokerages that Carmine had and lean on brokers, Ruggiero said. Ruggiero intended to compartmentalize his two lives, and he never told anyone at La Caravelle who he ran with. He would just tell me about where he grew up in Brooklyn and his past being a boxer, said former La Caravelle cook Fabrizio Salerni, who now works for Daniel Boulou. Violence, though, wasn't something Ruggiero could switch on and off. It nearly ended his nascent cooking career. One night, a few months after landing the job at La Caravelle, Ruggiero said he was mugged on the subway in Brooklyn. In the ensuing fight, Ruggiero grabbed the attacker's knife and stabbed him in the arm and stomach. I was out of control. I got on top of the guy and assaulted him, Ruggiero recalled. Ruggiero claimed self-defense, but the Brooklyn DA, seeing Ruggiero's arrest record, charged him with attempted murder. Ruggiero remembered spending 10 days in jail on Rikers Island until, he says, Lombardozzi's 40-year-old nephew, Danny Marino, bailed him out. Ruggiero said Marino instructed him to get out of town. Ruggiero returned to La Caravelle and begged Fessegade to find him a cooking job in France. He must have seen the emotion in my eyes, Ruggiero said. Fessegade sent Ruggiero to the Riviera to train under famed chef Jacques Maximin at the Michelin two-star restaurant Le Chanticleer and Nice's famed Hotel Negresco. The French press dubbed the 5'5" Maximin the Bonaparte of the ovens. Ruggiero found that his new boss lived up to the moniker. Maximin disdained American cooks and Americans in general. He said American products were shit. There was no American cuisine, and American chefs were all shit, Ruggiero recalled. But Ruggiero's outer borough background amused Maximin. You are not American. You're from Brooklyn, Maximin once joked. Maximin did not respond to a request for comment. After a year, Maximin sent Ruggiero to complete his apprenticeship with some of France's top chefs. First stop was Roger Verger, who had mentored Maximin, Boulou, and Alain Ducasse at his Michelin three-star restaurant Le Moulin de Mougins near Cannes. From there, it was on to Michel Gérard, who pioneered Nouvelle Cuisine at his spa restaurant in the Pyrenees. Ruggiero's final destination was Paul Bocuse's legendary restaurant L'Auberge du Pont de Cologne on the outskirts of Lyon. Meanwhile, Lombardozzi's crew cleaned up Ruggiero's legal problems. Next photo, clearing the table. Ruggiero said his son's death led him to leave organized crime. I knew that this has to end with me. And he's shown looking directly into the camera with his small dog beside him and the water in the background. And he is looking very, very serious. Guys visited my attacker at his mother's Brooklyn home and convinced him to not cooperate with the investigation, Ruggiero said. When I asked what they did, Ruggiero responded, "Let's just say they spoke the English this guy understood." In the fall of 1983, Ruggiero returned to New York. Le Caravel hired him back as associé, which was one step below sous-chef. He was 21. I asked Ruggiero why he didn't walk away from the mob when his food career was taking off. I had a terrible need to be wanted and respected, and I never felt like I belonged in the legitimate food world. In the street was where I felt respected, he said. I can't tell you the points I earned when I got then Gambino boss Paul Castellano a table at La Caravelle by telling them he was my uncle. Ruggiero's straight job gained the attention of Marino, an ascendant figure in the Gambinos. Danny loved food. You never saw him in a jogging suit. He didn't wear jewelry. His thing was beautiful suits and high-end restaurants. He was a different kind of gangster, Ruggiero said. Marino took over Lombardozzi's crew and began inviting Ruggiero to join his inner circle for a weekly Sunday meal of meatballs Marino hosted at his house in Brooklyn. Danny was so damn proud of his meatballs, Ruggiero said. Ruggiero recalled Marino giving him a printed copy of his recipe. At the bottom of the page was a warning. This paper will self-destruct if this recipe falls into unfriendly hands. Good luck. One time, Ruggiero said, after infamous Gambino capo John Gotti criticized Marino's meatballs, Marino didn't speak to Gotti for months. When Ruggiero returned to La Caravelle, the Nouvelle Cuisine Revolution was sweeping New York's French restaurants. The trend toward lighter, inventive cooking created previously unfathomable opportunities for young American chefs. In 1984, 32-year-old Michael Romano took over La Caravelle from Fessiger. Romano named Ruggiero his sous-chef. A few years later, Danny Meyer poached Romano to oversee the kitchen at Union Square Cafe. At 26, Ruggiero became La Caravelle's executive chef. The Gambino family was also in the midst of a revolution. 9 days before Christmas in 1985, Castellano was gunned down in front of Sparks Steakhouse in Midtown Manhattan. The unsanctioned hit on the family's boss was ordered by Gotti. I'll never forget. I was at La Caravelle. I got the call and ran over to Sparks. There were cops and photographers everywhere, Ruggiero recalled. Gotti's coup was perilous for Ruggiero because Ruggiero was aligned with Marino, a Castellano loyalist. John despised Danny, said former FBI agent Moe. A few months after Castellano's murder, according to investigators, Marino approved a revenge plot to kill Gotti with a car bomb. The device blew up Gambino underboss Frank DiCicco instead. Fearing reprisal, Ruggiero hid from Gotti's crew. We changed our habits and didn't frequent places that we normally did, Ruggiero said. Ruggiero's vaunted place in the restaurant scene would wind up protecting him from Gotti's wrath, because Ruggiero was a guy Gotti wanted to know. The thing you got to understand is, when wise guys get together, you know what's the first thing they talk about? What did you have for dinner last night? What did you have for lunch? What wise guys do most of the time is they talk about food, Ruggiero said. In April 1990, the fashion mogul Pierre Cardin hired Ruggiero to reinvent Cardin's restaurant, Maxim's. Gotti loved Maxim's, Ruggiero said. The Madison Avenue location was a virtual reproduction of the Belle Époque Parisian dining room with its Art Nouveau woodwork, pink table lamps, and rose-colored banquettes. In October 1990, Gotti asked Ruggiero to cater his 50th birthday at Maxim's. Ruggiero remembered papering over the windows so FBI agents surveilling Gotti couldn't peer inside, where 25 of the city's most powerful gangsters toasted Gotti with Jeroboams of 1961 Lafitte and magnums of Cristal Rosé. It was an effing shindig, Ruggiero said. Ruggiero's menu started with a buffet of beluga caviar, roasted loins of tuna, swordfish, and aged prime beef. For the main course, Ruggiero served a Gotti favorite, lute de mer, whole braised bass with fennel, butter, and flambéed with pernod. As Ruggiero carried the flaming platter into the dining room, he felt a searing pain in his hand. The sous chef had inadvertently splashed too much pernod on the fish, and it set Ruggiero's hand on fire. The flames leaped in the air, and the scent of fennel was mixed with slight odors of my burning flesh, Ruggiero recalled. He said he fought every urge to drop the platter so as not to enrage the explosive Gotti. The dinner turned out to be Gotti's last birthday as a free man. The FBI arrested the Teflon Don 2 months later on racketeering charges. He was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without parole. He died of cancer in 2002. As Ruggiero gained food world status, hiding his mob life was becoming increasingly difficult. In January 1992, Brian Miller awarded Maxim's 3 stars in the Times. Ruggiero should have scaled back his mob activity. Instead, he plunged deeper into gangland. I was a tortured person. I knew right from wrong, but at times I couldn't stop myself, he said. In the summer of 1992, the restaurateur Camille Duloc courted Ruggiero to take over the kitchen at Le Chantilly on East 57th Street. Duloc hoped Ruggiero could revive his venerable French restaurant, which had slipped in recent years. Ruggiero modernized the menu with Italian influences, such as crab ravioli and quail risotto. Not long after hiring Ruggiero, Duloc got good news. The Times and New York Magazine were going to publish reviews. One afternoon in early February 1993, Ruggiero said he was preparing dinner service when the maitre d' burst into the kitchen and informed him that police were in the dining room and a locksmith was at the front door changing the locks. Ruggiero ran to investigate. A man in a trench coat approached. He identified himself as a court-appointed auctioneer and said he was there to liquidate the restaurant. Le Chantilly had been in bankruptcy since 1991. Ruggiero said Duloc hadn't told him. I was furious, Ruggiero recalled. Ruggiero glared at the bar, where Duloc was forlornly sipping creme de menthe. He needed a way to keep the restaurant open until the reviews ran in a few days. A positive review would fill up the reservation book for months. Ruggiero looked at the auctioneer guy again. I know this effing guy, he thought. Then it clicked. He was a low-level hoodlum from Brooklyn named Bob Moneypenny. Yes, that's really his name. Ruggiero leaned over and whispered that he was a friend of Joe Watts. The blood drained out of his face, Ruggiero recalled. Joe, the German Watts, was a Gambino member and one of the most feared gangsters in the city. According to prosecutors, Watts was a backup shooter on Gotti's hit squad that whacked Gastiano. Phil Scala, the former FBI agent, told me Watts would have been the family's boss if both his parents had been Italian. He was a brilliant criminal, Scala told me. Moneypenny apologized profusely and called the court for permission to pause the liquidation. We opened at 5:30 like nothing happened, Ruggiero recalled. The following week, the Times and New York Magazine published rave reviews. Le Chantilly became one of the city's hottest tables. Money poured in. But the restaurant was still in bankruptcy. Ruggiero said he conspired with Moneypenny, who died in 2007, to rig the auction and buy the restaurant for $100,000. The cellar alone had $500,000 of wine in it, Ruggiero said. The plan was simple, according to Ruggiero. Legally, Moneypenny needed to advertise the auction in a newspaper. So he advertised it in the Staten Island Penny Saver, where few buyers would see it. However, a day before the auction closed, Ruggiero learned a guy in the garment district offered $150,000. Ruggiero said he sent three friends to reason with the bidder. Ruggiero got the restaurant. The purchase kindled Ruggiero's ambitions of restaurant moguldom. People bowed down to me when they found out I owned the place, he said. In the spring of 1994, Ruggiero checked his judgment at the door and partnered with Duloc to open an Italian restaurant called Nona. I asked Ruggiero why he continued to work with Duloc if, as Ruggiero claims, Duloc had hidden Le Chantilly's bankruptcy. It was a huge mistake, Ruggiero said. Ruggiero's much bigger error was, he said, accepting a six-figure investment from Marino. It violated Ruggiero's bedrock rule. Never borrow money from the mob. It was pure stupidity and ego on my part, Ruggiero said. Marino was about to do 6 years in federal prison on a murder conspiracy conviction. Ruggiero said Marino warned him that if Nona folded, Ruggiero and Duloc would repay him in full. Ruggiero and Duloc's partnership unraveled almost immediately after Nona opened, as both Ruggiero and multiple former employees of Le Chantilly told me. In August 1994, Ruggiero said he discovered Le Chantilly owed New York State tens of thousands of dollars in back taxes. New York City and state records show a series of tax judgments against the restaurant throughout the 1990s. Ruggiero said he wanted to cut ties with Duloc right then, but he couldn't without getting Marino's permission. Ruggiero went down to Ashland, Kentucky, to visit Marino in federal prison and explain the situation. Marino was not pleased, Ruggiero remembered. According to Ruggiero, Marino reminded him that Ruggiero had vouched for Duloc. Ruggiero promised he would get all of Marino's money out. On the afternoon of New Year's Eve, Ruggiero and Duloc's troubled partnership ruptured for good. Ruggiero said he caught Duloc on the sidewalk, taking a case of Cristal champagne from Le Chantilly. Ruggiero said he punched Duloc in the face, causing the bottles to smash on the sidewalk. I couldn't contain my rage, Ruggiero recalled. Duloc denies this, though a former Le Chantilly employee confirmed parts of Ruggiero's account. Ruggiero said the next day he called Duloc into a private room at Le Chantilly and put a dollar bill on the table. Consider yourself bought out, he told Duloc. You have an hour to clear out. When I come back, if you're still here, I'll kill you. While Duloc denies this as well, former employees recalled that Duloc didn't have a regular presence at the restaurant following the conflict. Still, this wasn't the street, and elbowing an unwanted partner aside took more than words. Ruggiero seethed as the partnership took its time to formally unwind. When another money matter arose between the two, something inside Ruggiero snapped. When I lost it, I didn't get crazy. I got quiet and cold, he said. According to Ruggiero, he assembled a crew from Brooklyn. One night in early 1995, they followed Duloc to the West Village and pulled him into a van and sped off. At first, he was indignant. He kept saying, I'm going to call the police, Ruggiero recalled. Ruggiero said he drove Duloc to a remote beach in Breezy Point, Queens, where, earlier that day, one of Ruggiero's guys had dug a hole in the sand. It was pitch black when we drove out there. When we pulled in, the headlights from the van shined on the hole. We dragged Camille from the van and marched him over to the hole. By this time, he was on his knees, begging for mercy. It was the middle of winter, but Ruggiero said he told Duloc to take off his shoes and socks, which Ruggiero threw into the Atlantic Ocean. Ruggiero said he then pulled out a contract he had had a lawyer draw up for Duloc to sign. I kicked him into the hole, we got in the van, and we left, Ruggiero said. Duloc denies this incident ever took place. Ruggiero said he regrets what happened. I did things when I was pushed that I'm not proud of, he said. But to really, truly be in the streets, you got to have a black heart. When you turn that switch, there can be no emotion. You have no pity. You got to just do it. One way Ruggiero rationalized his lawlessness was that the hospitality industry was not exactly a bastion of upstanding behavior. There are more thieves and deviants in the restaurant business than there are wise guys in the street, Ruggiero said. He also observed powerful New Yorkers act appallingly, sometimes violently so. They judged me, but they were no better, he said. Ruggiero recalled attending a meeting with Pierre Cardin and Maxime's landlord, the late real estate heiress Leona Helmsley, during which Helmsley called Cardin a little effing French fag. He said La Caravelle owner Robert Meisen once put the world-famous cardiac surgeon Christian Bernard in a headlock during an argument over whether Bernard should be seated despite arriving 25 minutes late for his reservation. In the end, they got Al Capone on tax evasion. David Ruggiero got pinched for credit card fraud. On Thursday afternoon, July 2nd, 1998, Ruggiero was filming a cooking segment at Macy's. When he got the news, police barged into Le Chantilly with a search warrant. He raced to the restaurant and found officers in orange Gambino squad vest removing the restaurant's financial records. The Manhattan DA wanted to indict Ruggiero and two employees for stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from Le Chantilly's credit card processing company by inflating tips. I didn't do the credit card crime, Ruggiero told me. There was enough evidence, though, that Ruggiero said famed mob lawyer Charles F. Carnese told him to take a deal. On March 11, 1999, Ruggiero pleaded guilty to attempted grand larceny. It was a ridiculously stupid thing to get caught for. Ruggiero didn't need the money. Vintner Robert Mondavi named Ruggiero one of the 13 best young chefs in America in 1995. Cardin had lured Ruggiero back to Maxime's the following year and made him a co-owner. Ruggiero was planning to open Pastis and Le Parc Meridien Hotel with a dining room designed by architect David Rockwell. He published cookbooks, taped a PBS series, and was signed by Food Network. After the credit cards, the press just categorized me as a moron, because I effed up my TV career. I had 5 restaurants, 650 employees, and it was gone, he said. The more painful thing Ruggiero lost was the respect of the gangsters that cooking had given him. Shortly after the credit card bust, Marino was released from prison and went to see Ruggiero at Le Chantilly. We sat in the back of the restaurant, and he said to me, I gotta ask you a question. Don't lie to me. Why the credit cards? What the F possessed you to do this shit? You had things that none of us could have had. I just sat there. There was nothing left to say, Ruggiero said. After that, Ruggiero drifted. He co-owned a strip club for a while. He ran a Jewish deli, a sushi bar, and a donut shop on the Upper West Side until those closed by 2014. That same year, Ruggiero was arrested for allegedly forging a check during a real estate deal gone bad. He said he pleaded guilty to one count of possession of a forged bank instrument and avoided jail time. On the morning of June 21, 2014, he got a call that his oldest son, Anthony, was dead. He did a lot of OxyContin and drank. He went to sleep and never woke up, Ruggiero said. Ruggiero knew his life and the mob was over when Marino didn't attend his son's funeral. Ruggiero told me he stopped returning Marino's calls. The mob had cost him the only two things that gave him joy, cooking and his children. I wouldn't have wished my life on anyone. I hate to sleep. The nights are very long and filled with nightmares, he told me recently. I didn't want to be a criminal. I want you to understand that. I loved being a chef. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Jamie Lee Curtis, the actor and advocate on living well, letting go, and learning to play the drums. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Knowing that each day I have lived wisely and loved well. What is your greatest fear? Not doing the above. What is your greatest extravagance? I am a replicant. I buy multiples of things I love. Bandolier phone cases, anatomy clothes, fleece Birkenstocks and fleece Merrill clogs, Armani lip balm. What is your favorite journey? Psychoanalysis. Which talent would you most like to have? I am currently taking drum lessons. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Eleanor Roosevelt. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I should have insisted on family dinners. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? February 2, 1999, when I realized I would die from opiate addiction. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My sobriety. Which living person do you most admire? Greta Thunberg. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Judgment. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Superiority. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Order, neatness. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My ankles. Which living person do you most despise? I try to remember that hurt people hurt people. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Far out. What is your greatest regret? Squandered time. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Christopher Guest, whose picture I saw in Rolling Stone in 1984, and I said to my friend who was sitting next to me, I'm going to marry that guy. And 8 months later I did, 37 years ago. When and where were you happiest? When I am in a creative flow. What is your current state of mind? To thine own self be true. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Lee from East of Eden. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A Lagerfeld rose. Where would you like to live? The Louisiana Museum of Modern Art in Denmark. But place it in the places I already live. What is your favorite occupation? Divesting. What are your favorite names? Rooney, Lulu, Ruby. What is your most marked characteristic? I hope kindness. What do you most value in your friends? Seeing and being seen. What is your most treasured possession? My Kathy Waterman child charm with Annie's and Ruby's names engraved. Who are your favorite writers? John Steinbeck, James Clavell, P.D. Eastman, Go Dog Go, Mark Nepo. Who are your heroes in real life? Bill and Lois Wilson, Deborah Hill, Dr. Bob Silkworth. What is it that you most dislike? Liars. How would you like to die? Alive. What is your motto? If not now, when? If not me, who? And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Jamie Lee Curtis. four horsemen of the forever war. How successive commanders-in-chief from Bush to Biden got caught in the Afghan quagmire, by Chris Whipple. Opening illustration by Brian Stauffer. Showing the president's faces as if on playing cards, toppling like dominoes with a Middle Eastern backdrop. Sometimes old warriors are the best peacemakers. George Washington famously warned against foreign entanglements. Dwight Eisenhower steadfastly refused to send American troops into harm's way. Those generals knew the cost of war in lives, American and foreign, and steered clear of far-flung quagmires. More recently, over two decades, four presidents took a different path, waging a star-crossed war in Afghanistan, where the United States military has now joined the British and Soviets in what has come to be known as the Graveyard of Empires. In a shambolic exit from Afghanistan, the last of those four presidents, Joe Biden, has proved that ending wars can be more difficult than waging them. The U.S. withdrawal that devolved into chaos, throngs of people stranded in the Kabul airport, panicked Afghans falling to their deaths from an American C-17, scores killed, including U.S. troops in ISIS-K suicide bombings, was both an operational fiasco and an intelligence failure. Leon Panetta, Bill Clinton's White House chief of staff, and Barack Obama's CIA director and defense secretary, watched the spectacle unfold in stunned disbelief. I had the same feeling that I had January 6th, he told me, looking at the U.S. Capitol and not seeing it surrounded by National Guard. To deal with a crazy crowd that everybody knew could attack the Capitol of the United States, I had the same reaction when I saw what was happening in Kabul. The failure of Biden's White House to foresee the Afghan regime's sudden collapse will be a focus of investigations to come. Yet there's plenty of blame to go around. No president, except perhaps Donald Trump, would say there's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of an embassy, as Biden did on July 8th, unless his intelligence briefers had told him so. I don't think there's any question that the intelligence community dropped the ball in terms of what ultimately happened here, Panetta insisted. A lot of people never expected that this thing would unwind as quickly as it did, but that's not an excuse. The irony is that America's longest war began as one of the CIA's finest hours. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 on George W. Bush's watch was a CIA-led triumph. As former CIA director and defense secretary under both Bush and Obama, Robert Gates explained, it was always predictable. The State Department would recommend the use of military force, the Defense Department would recommend diplomacy, and when they couldn't agree, everyone would decide, let CIA do a covert action. Indeed, sitting at Camp David just 4 days after the al-Qaeda attacks of 9/11, Bush turned to his CIA director, George Tenet. The agency's plan called for CIA paramilitary operatives, supported by military airstrikes, to launch an assault on al-Qaeda's Afghan sanctuary. When Tenet was done, Kofor Black, the CIA counterterrorism chief, looked at Bush. Mr. President, he said, when we get through with these guys, they're going to have flies walking across their eyeballs. On September 26, 2001, CIA paramilitary operatives lugging boxes stuffed with millions of dollars in bribes for warlords choppered into the Mountain Kingdom, linked with the warrior tribes of the Northern Alliance, and swept across the country. Within 10 weeks, they routed al-Qaeda, had Osama bin Laden on the run, rolled up the Taliban, and controlled Kabul. The shooting was over by December. Bush could have declared victory and brought his forces home. Instead, flush with bravado, the president and his advisors left them there and began beating the drums of war against Saddam Hussein. Hubris was the midwife of both America's unnecessary wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Troops and attention were diverted to the ill-conceived invasion of Baghdad. Out of sight and out of mind, a two-decade-long American engagement with Afghanistan had begun. No one had thought it through. We talk about nation-building, but we really didn't have a clear mission, Panetta told me, and we sure as hell didn't have an exit strategy to try to make sure that we protected the gains that had been made. American officials were woefully ignorant about both countries. Andrew Card, Bush's White House chief of staff, lamented to me, I wish that Lawrence Wright had written his book, The Looming Tower, before we went to war in Iraq. Policymakers didn't know the Sunnis from the Shia. It was an article of faith, proved tragically wrong, that U.S. troops would be welcomed as liberators. This was the same kind of groupthink that had led two American presidents, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson, to wage war in Vietnam. That unfortunate intervention, which lasted 10 years and cost 58,220 American lives, was based on the so-called domino theory. If the country fell to the communist Viet Cong, the nations of East Asia would topple one after the other. CIA Director Richard Helms commissioned a study that debunked the theory, but LBJ deep-sixed the memo, and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara conjured numbers and charts showing body counts that he insisted the enemy could not sustain. George Ball, the Undersecretary of State, and one of the few dissenting voices, never had a chance. So it went with Afghanistan. Obama should have known better. He was a voracious reader and avid consumer of intelligence. He had campaigned against forever wars and vowed not to do stupid shit. But under pressure from his generals, Obama kept the Afghan war going, approving a surge of 30,000 troops. He also announced a deadline for drawing them down, which only emboldened the Taliban to keep fighting. We didn't understand the nature of tribalism, Card told me. It was a problem in Iraq, and it was certainly a problem in Afghanistan. It didn't help that Obama couldn't stand to be in the same room with his special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, the blustering, self-promoting diplomat Richard Holbrooke, who could not stop comparing Afghanistan to Vietnam. Obama didn't want to hear it. But Holbrooke was right. As his biographer, George Packer, wrote, Holbrooke understood that all the questions in Afghanistan had been the questions in Vietnam. Could we transform their society? If not, could we still win the war? Did our very effort make it less likely? What leverage did we have? Should we get rid of their leader? Could we talk our way out? In his diary, Holbrooke wrote of Afghanistan back in 2009, It is beyond ironic that 40-plus years later we are back in Vietnam. Of course, everything is different, and everything is the same. Every program has its prior incarnation, mostly unsuccessful. Yet the 9/11 difference is also there. The Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese posed no threat to the U.S. Gates will be in the same spot as McNamara. Biden will play George Ball. And I think we must recognize that military success is not possible, and we must seek a negotiation. But with who? The Taliban are not Hanoi, and their alliance with Al-Qaeda is a deal breaker. Trump had promised to end the war, but as usual, he had no plan. He started peace talks in 2019 with the Taliban, but having announced that the U.S. was withdrawing, had no leverage. For dealmaker Trump, the Taliban's refusal to break with Al-Qaeda was not a deal-breaker. Nor the fact that the Afghan government was cut out of the talks. It was, of course, a show, the not-ready-for-Broadway tryout, starring the Mogul and the Mullahs, was supposed to come to Camp David just 3 days before September 11th, of all dates. It closed before opening night. Still, Trump set an American withdrawal date of May 1st, 2021, and privately boasted that he had dealt with the mullahs personally. He talked to the head of the Taliban, a former senior advisor told me, and he said, "I know where you live. I know where your family lives. If you harm Afghan women and children or come after Americans, I will do some crazy shit." When it came to the Afghan war, Biden had once been all in. During a trip to the country in January 2002, the then chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee wrote, "It was not the resolve of the Afghans that worried me." Famously empathic, Biden had a soft spot for Afghan women and girls, whose plight had improved immeasurably since the Taliban had been toppled in 2001. Biden's heart was with an Afghan girl whom he met at a school in Kabul. As he wrote in Promises to Keep, "As I stood to leave, I told the kids, 'I have to go now.' 'You can't go,' I heard someone say. I looked up and saw a 13-year-old girl standing ramrod straight in the middle of the classroom, so brave and so determined. 'America can't go,' she said. 'I must learn to read. I will be a doctor like my mother.' I wanted to walk over and hug her. 'No, no, no, honey,' I said. 'America is going to stay.'" And yet, Biden came to believe the war was unwinnable. He was souring on the government, warning that it could become a criminal syndicate. The bickering warlords, the opium trade, the armed forces' dubious morale. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.